This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to another attempt to save reality from a whirlpool of superstition, wishful thinking, and propaganda. You and I will work through the biggest change humanity has ever faced. But what is climate change and what is not? Can we hear the signal through the noise? Scientists know the world is warming, seas are rising, ice is melting, we can see that. The denial is all over. Economic realists know the era of never-ending growth powered by fossil fuels is also drawing to a close. Like any population in nature, we cannot grow forever. Those certainties reveal themselves in a slow grind and then again in sudden jolts. There are still a lot of guesses bound to be proved wrong. There is still room for doubt in the details. Here is just one small example. I have reported on the surge of jellyfish in many parts of the world, especially in the Mediterranean. But now, a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says, quote, "Recurrent jellyfish blooms are a consequence of global oscillations. A careful investigation shows there has been no increase in jellyfish over the past 200 years. It's a boom and bust species. There was another jelly wave in the 1970s, but nobody paid much attention. Another myth bites the dust. Later in this program, we're going to tackle a great divide between some climate scientists and the flood engineers on the ground, the experts in the United States. I've covered the wild floods in Nashville in May 2010 when the Grand Old Opry went underwater. There were more floods in Wisconsin and Minnesota that fall. And these heavily news-laden flood events, are they a sure sign of global warming? Maybe not, says Robert M. Hirsch, research hydrologist and a former associate director for water at the U.S. Geological Survey. Hirsch isn't a climate denier. He knows the world is warming and these floods are mostly human-caused, sure, but not from greenhouse gases, he says. It's a tricky problem which will work our brains hard as we talk with one of the prominent experts in American river systems and flooding. If the hydrological cycle is still one of the wild cards waiting to be seen, the promise of growing heat on this planet is as sure as the laws of physics. More carbon in the atmosphere traps heat energy that would otherwise have bounced back into space. We've known that for more than 100 years. In just a few minutes, I'm going to chat with one of the best environmental journalists, Mark Hertzgard. While his 7-year-old daughter waits in the room, Mark has to explain to us what we all have to explain to our children. The climate has already been disrupted and will change still more. Hertzgard's latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. I want to welcome our first full-time radio station to broadcast Radio EcoShock in Australia. 3CR has been one of those activist community stations pounding at the corridors of power and injustice since 1976, and that furthers my own vision for a global English language program as we witness and create the great change in climate, energy, agriculture, and our society, and we'll do it in order to survive the passing of industrial civilization. It seemed like the land down under was just getting a break from the weird, dangerous weather that struck that continent from 2009 onwards. Then, on the 5th of January, 2013, the brand new year, starting out in the Australian summer, I hear this from the Australian News Network.
Our southern states are sweltering through a heat wave tonight with little relief in sight. Three homes have been destroyed in a bushfire near Fawcett in Tasmania on a day when Hobart hit a record 41 degrees. Melbourne's experiencing the worst conditions since Black Saturday in 2009, while Adelaide had its hottest day in 4 years, a high of 45.
You heard that right. Parts of Australia hit 47 degrees C and more. That's over 117 degrees Fahrenheit. The average for the whole country was 39 degrees C, a sweltering 102 Fahrenheit. Here's what blows me away. The extreme heat was in the south of Australia, not in the tropical north where you might expect it. In the capital of South Australia, Adelaide, the thermometer went over 45 degrees. That's 113. Nobody goes outside air-conditioned spaces in that kind of heat. And then there's dear Tasmania, the coolish island pointing towards Antarctica. The Tasmanian capital of Hobart peaked out at 41.8 degrees C, the highest since record-keeping began 120 years ago. That's the kind of extreme we need to watch out for as this relentless warming develops during the next decade. The heat wave and lack of rainfall created ideal conditions for brush fires across southern Australia. Tasmania ignited into at least a dozen fires in a land known for its wet, cool forests. At least 100 homes burned and a town called Dunalley was destroyed, as we hear from ABC News Australia.
Tasmania has experienced its worst day of bushfires for at least 45 years. Catastrophic fire conditions sparked around 30 bushfires across the state. Many of them are still burning out of control. 80 properties have been destroyed and there are fears one person has been killed. Four of the fires have been so dangerous that residents have been advised to leave their homes. The town of Dunalley on the Tasman Peninsula was the hardest hit. Our reporter Felicity Ogilvy has just arrived there this morning. She had to travel into the town by boat because the bushfires have cut off the roads to Hobart. Felicity, what are you seeing?
Well, David, where there used to be houses, I am looking at twisted corrugated iron and just blackened out bricks where there used to be houses and burnt out cars here. The bush has been burnt out completely down to the waterfront. In the part of the main street I'm looking at now, there is just one house still standing and the local fish shed. It looks like most other houses are gone. And further up the canal, we know that the primary school has been burnt out here in Dunalley. And on the way into Dunalley this morning, around the Primrose Sands area, we saw a house still alight as the embers from the bushfire from the night before took hold of that.
So are there people still around, or did they all leave?
Yes, when we arrived by boat this morning, actually quite a few people came down to see if this was a way out of Dunalley from there for them, because as we said before, the roads are cut off here. People are desperate. They thought maybe we'll bring food to them. And as I've spoken to people around town this morning, I've heard tales of survival. One young couple who tried to stay to the end to defend their house, but then had to jump into the canal, and they were hiding there as the fire passed overhead. And I met a man, Greg Mann, who hid under a jetty up to his chest in the water with his young daughter. And he said after the fire front passed over that he went out and helped put out spot fires here in Dunalley.
I played a bit of that clip to prepare us all for the probability that superheat will stimulate burning forests in many parts of the world, even where you don't expect it. Maybe close to your own home. And what will you do? The Tasmanian bush will regrow, but some global forests will never come back, converting over to grasslands to entirely new ecosystems. But Australia is not escaping this year from the signs that it is a country destroying its own living space by ramping up their coal mining and exports. It's a race to the fiery bottom, mates. No more coal.
Radio EcoShock.
Speaking of extremes, here is another wild storm the press in the Northern Hemisphere mostly missed. You've heard about Hurricane Sandy, but what about Super Typhoon Bopha? Not so much, I'll bet. All credit to CNN weatherman Tom Sater for picking up on another climate-powered breakthrough reported December 4th, 2012.
Super Typhoon Bopha has just made landfall in the southeastern Philippines. This is the first time a super typhoon has ever come ashore in that country. Tom Sater is in the World Weather Center with a look at just how dangerous this storm can be. And Tom, you were talking to me a little bit earlier, and you used the word catastrophic.
Right. Unfortunately, Ralitza, I wish I had a fairy tale story like Max to share with you, but catastrophic is exactly what we're looking at when it comes to Mindanao. Now, we've had typhoons all over in the Philippines. They have them, and they're quite strong. But if you look at this view from space, I mean, this is over 22,000 miles, over 35,000 kilometers away, and you can see it. It's the bottom of the screen. Ralitza, there's so many factors and facets to this storm that make this so unusual, and this is why this is a big concern right now. As we get in a little bit closer. Mindanao is the second largest island in the Philippines, but because it's extremely south, it's close to the equator. Systems just don't develop. First of all, this time of year in December, if you talk about Mindanao in the month of December, I mean, they have typhoons, but once every 10 years. But they've never had one of this size. They've never had a super typhoon move into Mindanao. They just don't develop close to the equator. In fact, there's only one other one that we know of in recorded history that developed closer to the equator. But this is a monster storm. So it is an area that they've never needed to build up the defenses on the shoreline. This is unprotected shoreline. 1 year ago, this month, the 16th and 17th of December, it was tropical storm, a small tropical storm. It moved inland almost the exact same path, eerily similar, to Bhopal here, which the locals are calling Pablo. You may hear that. But what we're looking at is the amount of rainfall. 1,200 people lost their life with Washi as it moved in overnight, just hordes and torrents of water downstream, wiping out villages. This is what we call in meteorology as a midget typhoon. It's only 500 kilometers wide. Washi was another 100 kilometers larger, 600, but it's got a small, tight area of very strong winds, and that's what we're watching right now. Davao City, 1.5 million people. Butuan, about 60,000. It's not so much the winds, I think, that are going to knock out power to possibly a million. Look at the winds. 315 kilometers per hour. Ralitza, it's the rainfall. Typically, for the month, they may pick up 117. This could drop 200, 250, maybe 300. They do not have a defense line. And one note to pass along to you. Just heard from officials, local officials, 3,400 people are stranded on piers. I don't understand. They did not get out in time, and the ferry service is cut off. They're stranded on piers with no protection. We'll be watching this one closely.
This time with Bopa, only hundreds died in the Philippines, not the thousands in the much smaller cyclone Washi, a.k.a. Sendong, in December 2011. I guess part of my point is there is a southern hemisphere, people. Big things happen in countries that don't have major international news services. The climate is going out of control far beyond London and New York. We need a system of monitors, blogs, news, and alerts to remind us a global problem is unfolding. There are so many untold stories in South America, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific, and so many ears who tune all that out. I'll wrap up this ramble with just one more story that caught my eye this week. Al Jazeera reports the Mexican drug gang called the Zetas Cartel is moving into coal mining. Reporter John Holman writes on January 4, 2013, on October 7, Mexican Marines swooped in on one of the most powerful men in organized crime. But as the Navy triumphantly announced the death of Heriberto Lascano, leader of the Zetas gang, there was puzzlement over where he had been found. Far from the Zetas strongholds and practically unprotected, he had been watching a baseball game in the small mining village of Progreso. Theories abounded as to what exactly Lascano had been doing in Progreso, a one-horse town in the wide-open spaces in the southern state of Cahuilla. Humberto Morer, ex-governor of Cahuilla, says that he has the answer. Quote, Heriberto Lascano changed from being a killer, kidnapper, and drug dealer to something still more lucrative, mining coal. That's why he lived in the coal region in a little village called Progreso. End quote. Speaking to Al Jazeera, Morer says that the Zetas gang is fast discovering that illegal mining is an even more lucrative venture than drug running. They discover a mine, extract the coal, sell it at $30, pay the miners a miserable salary. It's more lucrative than selling drugs. And that ends my quote from reporter John Holman of Al Jazeera. The Mexican government has confirmed the drug gangs have infiltrated the coal mines in the state of Cahuilla. Why do I think that matters? It says everything about where we are going. Sure, there's already a criminal conspiracy to mine climate-damaging coal in the United States. In fact, two U.S. senators have just called for an investigation into the low rates given to big mining corporations on publicly owned lands, and that's in the Powder River Basin of eastern Montana and Wyoming. After a call by Western ranchers, the Reuters News Service investigated how Cloud Peak Energy Corp., Arch Coal, and Peabody Energy Group got such low royalties while making a fortune exporting that coal, not to the United States, but to Asia. Criminal charges are possible. Everybody with a brain knows it's just as criminal to blow the tops off the Appalachian Mountains to get the coal. Plus, the coal lobby has their dirty hands in the federal government in Washington for a generation or two. They make sure the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't clear up the air too much. Millions have died breathing dirty coal pollution around the world, and no president seems able to stop it. The Zeta gang could never kill so many or make so many billions of dollars doing it. But I think organized crime is the future of coal. As more people around the world realize they can't cope with extreme climate change, they will demand an end to coal. We can't rebuild fast enough from major climate damage. We can't find the money or the will. We can't stand the floods or the heat waves and the droughts. Months of hot cities well over 35 degrees C in the hundreds Fahrenheit will motivate a lot of people. Eventually, many of us can't survive in a 4-degree warmer world. We'll call for an end to coal. When that social tipping point comes, there might be a war on coal, just like the failed wars on terrorism or drugs. Where governments try to suppress the last killing mines, organized crime will fill the need. Coal will come out of the black market, literally the underground economy. It won't surprise me if a minor war is fought in a coming decade, not to get the coal, but to stop it from reaching the damaged atmosphere. And how will we survive then? Mark Kurtzgaard is here to tell us. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. First, climate change was coming. Now it's here in storms, rising seas, and much more. Our guest, Mark Kurtzgaard, first came to my attention with his late 1990s book, Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. That came after a quest of many years to find our impact on the natural world. Since then, I've read Mark's leading-edge work in Vanity Fair, Newsweek, The New Yorker, and in his current post as environmental reporter for The Nation magazine. Mark Kurtzgaard, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
I appreciate you finding the time. You've been extra busy lately, published not just in The Nation, but also your December 10th article in Newsweek. That's a good place to jump in. What has climate change got to do with pasta?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to say this for my beloved 7-year-old daughter. The piece that ran in Newsweek that you're referring to is called The End of Pasta, because of what climate change threatens to do to wheat. And, of course, pasta is made from wheat. And when I was describing this story one evening to a fellow journalist who was over visiting and giving him the 30-second elevator pitch for it, I neglected to notice that my 7-year-old was off in the corner there, and turned out that she was listening more closely than I thought, and she said, "No, Dad, you can't have the end of pasta. After all, I am Italian." And because she's Italian-American. And so I told her that, that's why I wrote this article, so that we can try to prevent the end of pasta, because, you know, there is still an awful lot that we can do if we get started quickly and act very, very urgently. There's a lot we can do, not only to protect wheat and therefore pasta for mac and cheese-loving little kids all over America and around the world, for that matter, but also things that we can do to prepare our communities for the amount of climate change that is now unstoppable, and to prevent that amount of climate change from being unsurvivable. There is, unfortunately, an awful lot of inertia in the climate system that we cannot prevent. There are going to be increasing difficulties in the years ahead, but we need to work very rapidly now to keep those difficulties relatively manageable.
Well, you know, I've talked with Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, and he's warning for every 1 degree rise in temperature, we'd expect about a 10% drop in world grain production. And now it seems like everybody from Kevin Anderson to the World Bank is warning a 4-degree rise is maybe the new normal by 2050. So doesn't that lead to some horrible math for a world expecting to feed 9 billion people?
It does if we let that 4 degrees happen. So we simply can't do that. If we allow 4 degrees centigrade of temperature rise in this century, that will basically create a situation where civilization as we know it will not survive. Not least because when you have a 4 degree C temperature rise, some of the impacts that would unleash, such as melting vast stores of methane that are underneath the tundra in Russia and Upper Canada. That would create a situation where global warming becomes, in effect, irreversible. And so we simply can't allow that to happen, it seems to me. I mean, again, I say this as the father of a seven-year-old, and it really, it does change your perspective on that. You were kind enough to mention Earth Odyssey. When I wrote Earth Odyssey in the 90s, I wasn't a dad. And in fact, in my new book, Hot, I talk about how, in the very first paragraph, about when I was traveling around the world in the 90s, like most international journalists, I've seen a lot of terrible things happen to kill children. But they were always other people's children. And when it's your kid, there is something different that kicks in. And so that was what led me to write the book Hot, because my daughter had just been born when I was on assignment for Vanity Fair right after Hurricane Katrina, and went to London and learned from the chief science advisor of the British government, Sir David King, that we were now, as a planet, already locked into a significant amount of climate change over the next 50 years, even if we act very quickly. And so the challenge, Alex, really is to keep that 4 degrees C temperature rise from happening. There is, we've already had 1 degree C from the amount of greenhouse gases that are already up there. We've desperately got to keep that to the minimum amount possible.
Well, let's get specific. What's happening with wheat, say, in the United States?
Yes, for this story for Newsweek, I went out to North Dakota, which who knew, but North Dakota is where some of the best pasta in the world begins. They happen to have just the right, or have had, I should say, just the right set of climatic conditions to grow some of the best durum wheat in the world, which, just parenthetically, most wheat in the world is used to make bread, but durum wheat is what you use to make pasta. And already in the last 30 to 40 years, the pasta wheat growing area in North Dakota has been dramatically shifted by climate change. You used to be able to grow durum throughout the state of North Dakota, and over the last 30 years, that has shifted. The growing zone has shifted west. And so the eastern half of North Dakota, almost no durum is grown now. Now it's grown in the western half and even into eastern Montana and the neighboring region in Canada. Ironically, one of the things that means is that the durum zone, by climate change, has pushed the durum growing zone into the very area of North Dakota, Montana, Canada, where there is now one of the biggest oil booms in recent history underway, the Bakken oil boom out there. And so that was a remarkable thing for me to see as a reporter, to go out and talk to the durum wheat producers out there and to see their land now being taken over by oil drilling and natural gas drilling, which, of course, is only going to make climate change worse. So you see both sides of the problem there. You know, it's not just in North Dakota. We've already seen over the last 50 years, the temperature rise of the last 50 years has already reduced globally, has reduced wheat production by about 5.5% from what it would otherwise have been. So, you know, these impacts are happening now. They are projected to get much worse unless we act very, very rapidly to get off of fossil fuels and onto the clean, green economy of the 21st century.
Well, with this drought and with floods in other parts of the world, like Great Britain, we're already seeing rising food prices. But we saw a more violent and immediate threat in Hurricane Sandy. Congress almost failed to pass legislation to help rebuild New York and New Jersey after the storm. What do you make of that?
Well, during the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations, the House of Representatives, the Republican leadership there, declined to take up that bill to provide even relief to the New York, New Jersey area. They got such a political backlash, including from fellow Republicans like Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, that now they've backtracked and the Republican leadership will allow a vote. But I think the larger point here is that, unfortunately, the United States is still very, very far behind the rest of the world in its, what I like to call, the social capital response. You know, as we prepare for climate change, lots of the interest and focus is on technical questions and physical infrastructure. Can we build a seawall around New York City to protect it against sea level rise and storms? And that's all important. But really, the most important is the question of social capital. What kind of a society do you have? Do you have a society that believes in science, that values science, that believes in government, that is willing to be taxed in order to pay for public services? And when I was writing my book, Hot, about how to deal with the next 50 years of climate change, I went and spent quite a bit of time in the Netherlands, which, of course, has been dealing with these issues for many, many years because they're such a low-lying coastal country. And one of the greatest advantages that the Dutch have is that they do have that kind of social capital. They believe in science. They believe in government. They believe in collective action. They are willing to pay taxes, and they trust their government to invest those taxes properly to defend the nation against storms and flooding and so forth. That is what is really lacking in the United States, and nowhere more than in the Republican Party, which, very unfortunately from a climate perspective, the Republican Party continues to be able, inside of Capitol Hill, to block most important initiatives here. And unfortunately, we saw that in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
Well, yeah, but the Republicans paid for it in the recent elections with the Latino vote. What did you find out about people of color and climate?
Yeah, that was such a remarkable development. I wrote about that in The Nation. I think it's one of the real unsung positive developments out of 2012. And you're right. I think that even before that happened, that Hurricane Sandy had a real impact on the presidential race, despite Barack Obama's shameful silence on the issue for most of the campaign. But then Mother Nature itself spoke up and said, okay, you know, climate change is here and it's real. But aside from the president's silence, I think he still benefited because, as you mentioned, Latinos and other groups, but especially Latinos, voted for Obama at almost a 75% to 25% preference over Mitt Romney. And part of that, of course, was Romney making very insensitive remarks about immigration. For example, during the Republican primaries, he urged that Hispanics self-deport to solve the immigration issue. But it was also a matter of the environment. And it's oftentimes misunderstood. People tend to think of the environment and climate change in particular as an issue that that's those Prius-driving, upper-middle-class, white environmentalists. Well, in fact, the data shows, and especially here in California where I live, that Latinos and almost as much African-Americans, Asian-Americans, and especially youth of all races, they care about climate change very, very much. In fact, there's an enormous gap on the climate issue for Latinos. They support action on this, including government action. It's not just that they believe that climate change is real. They want the government to do something about it by astonishing margins, 20% to 80%. Only 20% of Latinos are not concerned about this. And in the 2012 election, Latinos and youth in particular and these other groups that I mentioned, they voted in large numbers. And so this is, a very encouraging thing going forward if, and this is a big if the mainstream environmental movement can recognize this fact and respond accordingly. Because traditionally and frankly for too long, the U.S. environmental movement has been dominated by, you know, very well-meaning, but white, upper-middle-class people who are older and who see issues of environmental justice as something that, you know, it's nice and they should do it and it's the right thing to do. And what they really need to understand is that, no, this is the future of the environmental movement. You're not doing these people any favors. They're the ones who are going to be doing a favor for you. Because if environmentalists want to win in the United States, they need to put Latinos and blacks and Asian Americans at the front of the movement and to find ways to deal with those issues, not just as one political consultant says, you can't just talk about butterflies. You've got to talk about jobs. Because, you know, it's Latinos and African Americans and others, they're the ones who generally are living closest to the coal-fired power plants, the oil refineries, and all the other pollutants that are killing them on a daily basis, not just the long-term dangers of climate change.
We'll be right back with more of Mark Hertzgard with his book Hot, plus Robert Hirsch. Is flooding really from global warming? Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock.